Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. It's Jesse Green at the control panels as always, and today I'm joined by my friend Terry Tran from thefreedomtrader.com. In this conversation, you're going to hear all about Terry's life story, which is incredibly fascinating because Terry's life began in the most adverse of circumstances. His family fled from post-war Vietnam, they ended up in refugee camps and finally made it to Australia. Terry's career has been incredibly stellar. He's had a very successful finance career in traditional business. He's been able to create tremendous wealth for himself and his family through his share trading and through his interest in being able to trade on the stock market. He's even had correspondence back from Warren Buffett. Now, Terry is an incredibly generous guy, and in this conversation, we're going to be talking about why it's so important to build wealth outside of your practice. Terry's going to share his 3P formula, what makes a great investor. We're going to be talking about why farmers are so good at investing and what others can learn from farmers. He's also going to be talking a lot about some of the fundamentals, things to consider, whether it's risk, all those other things that go into being astute financial managers. Now, of course, I'm not a financial planner and this podcast does not in any way constitute financial advice. So you do check with your advisors to make sure that everything that you want to do is covered off with your own individual advisors. But this conversation with Terry is really illuminating. It's going to give you some real food for thought so you can start thinking about building a vehicle outside of your practice as part of a wealth creation strategy and as part of a risk mitigation strategy. Terry's incredibly generous with his knowledge, and I'm so delighted to be able to welcome him to the podcast. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it with him. Here he is. Terry, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day. How are you, my friend?
Very well, and thank you for having me.
Oh, mate, it's absolutely a pleasure. Now, Terry, these days you are most well known for running the Freedom Trader, and I'm curious to ask you, firstly, when you got into that line of work, was that a plan? Was that a career path you'd mapped out from the beginning, or is it something that just evolved over time? I'm just curious to ask what your business actually does and then how you found your way into it.
Right. No, it definitely was not part of the plan. What ended up happening was I started off, actually, my background is I'm actually a migrant kid all the way from post-war Vietnam. And exactly 40 years ago, it is my 40th year in Australia, my parents, post-Vietnam War, we lost everything. So we swapped whatever we had into gold bars and took the boat trip on an 80-meter tug and hopefully find new land, Australia. But however, we actually never made it. So our boat started taking on board water and we were lost out at sea for about 3 days. So lucky enough that a cargo ship did find us and transported us to a nearby refugee camp off the coast of Malaysia. And it was there that I saw, I guess, even as a young child, seeing my mother go through financial hardship.
Mm.
So my plan really was in the end, as an Asian kid, was to listen to my mum. Lucky enough, Australia accepted us, our family, to the country, and listen to my mum, study hard, get a corporate job, and you know, start my life that way. And then, of course, having the financial foundation to look after my mother. Mm. So that was really my plan in life.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious to ask around that, mate, because I was unaware of that part of your background, and I'm curious to ask how that experience has really shaped your view of the world. Clearly, there's going to be some sort of effect around security and planning and all those sorts of things. How was that experience for your family?
It affected me a lot. Reason being is because one thing I didn't mention was my father sadly actually passed away through a freak accident on the island. So my mum, at the age of 22, became a widow. And towing around a two-year-old definitely was not fun. However, when we got to Australia, I saw her financially struggle from working at a factory during the daytime,
mm-hmm.
Tagging me along. And mm-hmm. I basically spent a lot of my days colouring books at inside of the female toilet, outside of it, because it was the coolest part of the factory. Then seeing her learn English in the afternoon and then going off, trudging off at nighttime with me in tow again to wash dishes at an Indian restaurant. So financial security was one thing that I really saw was very important. But then the other part that I think also shaped me was I learned that there, in actual fact, what ended up happening was a very kind-hearted gentleman on the island, which we did not know at all, but he saw my mum's situation and actually helped my mother out in terms of, helping bury my father and things like that. Mm. And I saw what wealth can actually do for someone. In other words, can help people. Mm. So I decided I wanted to become a banker as well as a financial planner and help people down a track. So that was my career path in the NAB. So I became a financial planner and subsequently a fund manager, and I looked after people's money as well. So that shaped me into, I guess, where I am today. Teaching was never part of the plan. However, when I left corporate life, I got caught up into, I call them get-rich-quick type seminars and programs. Mm. And out of that experience, I lost about 100 grand, a lot of my savings from NAB.
Wow.
And I realized, and that was only an 18-month period, and I realized, wow, getting caught up and learning from people who were, I guess, unscrupulous operators because they were teaching for a living but not doing for a living. Mm. And I learned the hard way. And until I learned from the real people, basically people who managed money, then I realized everything that I was doing wrong. Mm. And it was only about, 4 years ago that I keep on seeing people still getting hurt these days, being caught up in these type of so-called get-rich-quick seminars. And I thought, why should I? I didn't want to see that happen because I experienced that 20 years ago. Mm. So I decided to start writing a blog just out of interest. And I got picked up by a publication in the United States. And they liked my writing because I didn't have any financial jargon.
Yeah.
And they asked me to write for their column every Thursday. And I'd be on their front page every Thursday. Wow. So that's how I started this whole, I guess, journey of teaching. So it was really through a blog. And I realized, I should structure a program so I can teach step by step. And, of course, the Freedom Trader was born.
Yeah, wow. So I'm curious to ask, as you went through that process, Terry, losing 100K is a lot of money, and 20 years ago is a real lot of money. It's still a lot of money, but back then even more so. I'm curious to understand, as you went through that process, because there'll be people listening to this particular podcast who might have had a similar experience. They might have lost some money. They might have just been through something quite dramatic like that. What was your emotional response to that? I'm curious to ask because that can break some people, but for others it can harden their resolve. And in your case, it sounds like it hardened your resolve, but I'm curious to understand what you went through as you lost that dough.
At first, it was definitely very painful.
Mm.
When I look back, I realize that now I feel like it was probably a blessing because I learned way a hard lesson, but at a very young age.
Yeah.
So it was a good thing.
Yeah.
However, definitely very painful. And I remember going to my newlywed wife. I said, basically, it's gone. Would I be able to have a fresh start? And literally how I started was taking equity out of our loan again for the next 30,000 and then 50,000 from an equity loan because all the cash was already gone.
Mm, wow.
Yeah. So definitely very painful. But I vowed to go in search for the people who taught. So I reached out to Warren Buffett himself and surprisingly, he wrote back within 2 weeks. And that sort of opened up a lot of doors to realizing, wow, there's great fund managers out there that are willing to have lunches with me, coffees with me, and I just lapped it up. And that's how I learned the craft from people who actually did it for a living and managing billions of dollars.
I think that's the real key, isn't it? It's that whole story about doing for a living versus teaching for a living. And I know that every time you and I catch up, you're actively doing what you do. You're not just teaching for a living. You've got your own portfolio and you're really, really active. And I know that forms 90% of what you do in life. So I really, really appreciate that because, again, I think it separates the men from the boys when it comes to teachers, and I really appreciate that. So I wanted to ask you, Terry, as you went through that journey, gathering the knowledge, what is it that made you such a good student? Because, again, I'm curious to understand that because I think people listening to this podcast will perhaps be being mentored in one form or another, and I'm curious to understand you were able to take that knowledge, you're able to go and meet those people, have those coffees, and then assimilate that knowledge and importantly apply it. What is it that you think made you such a good student? Because I think being a good student is critical in life, and I'm just curious to understand your take on that.
Right. I think firstly, it's vitally important that one has a goal. Mm. So my goal was one, look after my mom.
Yeah.
And then finally have that freedom, that word freedom in life, because I never had it as a child. So I was very hungry to achieve that goal. And in order to do so, was to really learn and apply whatever knowledge I was able to get.
Mm.
So from the moment I learned from someone, my next step was how do I action this?
Mm.
And yes, there might be mistakes along the way, but you learn quick, fail fast, move on, mm-hmm. and keep on learning.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, mate. So let's fast forward a couple of years now, and you've got the Freedom Trader, and you're going very well with that, and that program of yours is really well regarded. You know, I've read about it in various publications, and everything that I've observed, seen of you, as well as the things I've read and heard external, has been really positive and very, very uplifting. What I wanted to ask you is a little bit about some of the things when it comes to investing that really set the good investors apart from the mediocre investors. You've had the opportunity to work with lots and lots and lots of people, and I'm sure you've observed some traits, some characteristics around that. And what is it that you think that separates the good ones from the mediocre ones?
Right. I think firstly, I call it the three P's of successful investing. Mm. And it's got to do with the first P being process-driven. So knowing and having a system that actually works and you know it works through thorough testing, but at the same time, being confident that it works because you've tried it on a small scale and then you scale up. Because a lot of people, when they come into the markets, right, I think there's a bit of greed that comes in because they want to make money right away and make money fast. But I always say, you know, hang on there, scale it back down. No matter how much money you have, it does not matter. You should always start small. And if you're given a system, practice on a small account first because psychologically you can't handle the system yet. Mm. And as you get confident and you've got runs on the board, in other words, like for example, our students, when they do every 10 investments or trades, usually between 8 and 9 of them are right or correct or winners. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you're getting that run rate, then automatically your confidence does soar.
Yeah.
However, even if you're making mistakes, it's okay because it's still on a small scale. So it doesn't not even financially hurt you, but at the same time, it doesn't mentally torment you as well.
Yeah.
So therefore, being process driven, but having and knowing that a system works, that's firstly fundamental and key. I usually want to relate it back to, like, you know, we've got about 200 farming students on our program, and that's quite a big number. And I would say that they are probably one of the most incredible students because in farming, as you're probably aware, they're very process-driven,
yeah.
Extremely process-driven, so they know that they have to plant a seed at a certain time of the year. If they miss that period of time, there's nothing to show for, you know, when come harvest time.
Yep.
So they plant the seed, so process, done. And how to do it, of course, that's also part of the process. And then the other one is also persistence as well, because sometimes when you're learning something, it is also potentially hard, especially when you're just starting out. It may be a second language to you, it does take a bit of time to get used to it until it becomes second nature. So you got to be persistent to go through that process as well and push through the whatever obstacles you might be telling yourself. And then finally, why I say farmers are so are great investors is also that third P, which is patience.
Mm.
Because farmers had that in spades. They know when they plant, they got to wait for the harvest, for the plant to grow. And if you've got all those three P's all lined up, it's very hard to not become a successful investor or trader.
Yeah, I love that. That's a wonderful metaphor, mate. And interestingly enough, when I was a uni student, going back quite a few years now, on the uni holidays, I used to go and work on farms. Actually, I used to go and work on cotton farms. And it's probably some of the hardest work I've ever done in my life, I must confess. And it certainly made me study harder when I got back to uni because I thought, man, right. I don't think I want to do this. But I remember, interestingly enough, part of our job was to go cotton shipping. So anyone who's listening to this from the country will know that's pretty hard work. It's pretty menial work. But as a uni student, it allowed me to save a bit of money and do all that. And one of the things I noticed is when it came to planting the crops, it was also really important to, as part of that process, is to make sure you're getting rid of the weeds, right? And so I'm wondering, what are the financial weeds that we need to keep an eye on as we go through this process of farming, looking at having a process, making sure that we're persistent and patient? What are the sort of weeds that we need to be mindful of that can creep into our investing methodology or things that could derail that lovely 3P process?
Right. The weeds is, funny enough, sometimes, especially with our the system that we have, because it is quite process-driven and it is quite, in terms of win rate, it is quite high. One of the weeds, I think it's on the psychological front, is that when people start getting too confident, when they're having too many wins on the board, and we had a student, an incredible student by the name of Tony Carla, and he literally had 46 investments straight up front, all winners. And what happens when you have that type of win rate without any one loss is that you start to think that you're almost invincible.
Mm.
And you start to think that, oh, this is just like almost like a lottery system. But in actual fact, it isn't, because it's eventual that you're going to have losses along the way. So one of the biggest weeds is also probably on the psychological front of not getting too greedy in thinking and relaxing all your risk management criteria and processes. So that's definitely one major thing that you do need to be aware of. And the other thing too is I think also on the fear side as well, because I mean, on a daily basis, you're probably aware that headlines, news headlines, global, especially in the markets, global economic factors always feature on the news. So, you know, when President Trump does a tweet and all of the market plummets, things like that, it happens. And as long as you, if you don't have a process that is in place to make ensure that you know what's happening around the world, therefore you get driven by the headlines and you follow the crowd. And what you want to do is be contrarian and actually invest totally opposite of the crowd. So when people start panicking, in actual fact, it's a buying opportunity. And when people start getting too euphoric, it's potentially a selling opportunity to get out of it and then hold back cash to take advantage of the imminent pullback that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So fear and greed.
Fear and greed. Okay, cool. And mastering those two emotions is actually pretty hard because as human natures, we are all hardwired to be social animals and we follow the crowd and we do those things. So I think all of us understand the concept, buy low, sell high. I nearly got it the wrong way. But we're all intellectually capable of understanding that. But when it comes time to actually follow through emotionally, it can be quite challenging. So for people listening to the podcast who might be thinking about investing, how do you go about mastering the fear and the greed? Is it simply by going, you know what, I'm just going to fall back to my system. I'm going to fall back to my process. Is that really the way around fear and greed?
The following the process is definitely one way. But like you said, the fear and greed, that is one thing hard to master. And the reason why, especially in the financial markets, is because it's because of what I call that word position sizing. The word position sizing, all it means is that when you find an investment opportunity, how much money do you put into that market? And when people get caught up, it's when they usually have too much on the line in that one particular investment. So if it's not diversified and they've got way too much, say, you know, 20% of their portfolio or something in that one investment, there is no way you're not fearful about it if something goes wrong or some bad news about the company may pop up. So one way to totally get around it, and it's very rational as well, is if you limit the investment. For example, every investment we make at any point in time, any one stock is only 1%.
Wow.
It's really 1%. So you can imagine if you've got a $100,000 portfolio, only $1,000 goes into that one stock and that is it.
Wow.
So that's one position. So therefore, if it's that small, what ends up happening is that you're very relaxed about it. So when the time comes to buy or sell, you literally have no emotional attachment. Yeah, so that's one easy way and simple way to get rid of that fear and greed factor.
Yeah, and again, going back to the farming metaphor, if you're on a cotton farm like I was, look across to the next paddock and I guarantee you it's not cotton. It's exactly the same thing. They'll have other crops in place. And the risk mitigation part, I think, is really critically important, not just for investing, but also for business as well. Which leads me to ask the question, Terry, when it comes to thinking about business, I'm often of the view that there are really two businesses that we're in. One that generates the income, in our case, dental practices. And then there's the other business of creating wealth outside of the practice. And I'm a huge fan of creating wealth outside the practice. We have a methodology in the work that we do is about creating a profitable, scalable, and valuable business. And what that whole process is designed to do is to create surplus cash flow, create surplus time, and create wealth within the business itself. But the surplus cash flow is really designed to be taken out and have something sensible done with it, you know, like what you do. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are around business owners creating wealth outside their business, some of the common challenges that come up, whether it's farmers or otherwise, because I know you work with a broad cross-section of people. What are the things that you see in that space?
Yeah, I think it's vitally important that, first of all, what you said is correct. Wealth needs to be created outside the business, whatever industry you're in, because by doing so, it allows you to therefore know that no matter what happens to the business, whether a downturn in the economy, in the business itself, then you and the family are always safe financially. And the other thing that I see as well is if you're able to create that wealth outside the business, you can imagine if you've got something very powerful that literally replaces the income of the business, so the business becomes almost secondary. And if you know that there's something already outside that always protects you financially, you in fact can literally take on board even more risk inside the current business by expansion or things like that, because you're never worried that if something goes wrong, then you're sort of strapped because you know that there's something else outside that protects you no matter what.
Yeah.
But that's how I see the that wealth effect of us creating something very powerful outside the business.
Yeah, I think it's really relevant and pertinent. Just today, I was looking at a Facebook group, actually, and one of the questions that came out of that particular group, there was a person, I won't mention a name, who was making a very reasonable observation that they were the key person risk in their business, that they were driving home and something happened, that's it, game over. And so I think, you know, really it is incumbent upon all of us who are in that position of perhaps being, you know, income generator for the family or otherwise, that we do start to develop that second stream of income. Yep. So when it comes to developing that second string of income, again, in the position that you're in, you see lots of people, what are the things, if you could tap people on the shoulder and say, hey, listen, there's a better way than that. Or equally, what common mistakes do people make as they're having that thought about creating the second income stream? What sort of things do you wish you could say, hey, just don't do this, have a look at that. What sort of things would you share on that front?
Okay. First of all, is for one thing, definitely take the time that you require. Now, never get caught up in the next shiny object, I call it. Because a lot of people chase these certain things that, and I call them, you know, again, going back to that get rich quick thing, where people see this such shiny object and then they gravitate towards that and they end up losing a whole bunch of money. So it's very important and vital that, firstly, whatever you're about to invest in, firstly, you understand
it. Yeah.
And do a bit more, you know, due diligence on research. And also, whoever you're learning from, potentially, know their background. What is it that they do? Do they actually hopefully teach, not just teach for a living, but do it for a living? And whenever you're also given a tip from a family or friend, don't just take it at face value. Always do your own research.
Yes, that's a biggie, isn't it? Yeah, how many family barbecues have happened over the last, I don't know, year or two or three? And there's always someone with, it's like the Melbourne Cup almost. It's like the horse in barrier seven's a sure thing. And, you know, you get these tips as it relates to stocks and shares and people going, oh, you know, you've got to get in on such and such a share. It's, you know, it's sure to do well. And interestingly enough, I received a tip around that not so long ago. And you go, okay, fair enough. That's nice. Thanks for that. And then you just park it. But again, I'm just curious to understand from your perspective, as you've been going through your own learning and dealing with someone like Warren Buffett. I mean, I don't know anyone who's had a letter back from Warren Buffett other than you, Terry, which is great. Mm. What sort of things have surprised you in your own journey? What are the things you kind of go, wow, I didn't expect that or I didn't see that coming? What have been the things in your own journey that you've gone, wow, that's been really interesting?
I think what when you do this long enough, especially I've done it for about 20 years now, and the market cycles, the number of, not only the number of market cycles that we come through, I mean, the last, 10 years ago, it was a GFC. Mm. So that I never saw the size of the drop in the markets. So that was one thing. And I was very thankful that we were able to sidestep that because we saw things way in advance. So we were early. We were about 3 or 4 months early. Mm. But then we saw that coming. And we didn't know the exact day, but we knew it was early and it actually happened. So that really surprised me of the size and the speed of the market drop. The other thing too was Brexit. That really surprised me. I did not expect that to happen. So that was a market-related event. But then, of course, there's one thing that you can actually do as well is literally see whether a market-related event like a Brexit is in fact going to be totally harmful to the world economy, or is it actually just a very localized event? And even with the market plummeting, you can take advantage of that. And in actual fact, we did during that Brexit. So it was one of the most profitable periods that we've ever had during Brexit.
Wow. Well. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I reckon there's a few Brits who are going to be listening to this podcast and going, man, I wish I'd known Terry at the time, because I'm pretty sure some of the Brits might have had a different experience of Brexit around that. But anyway, that's really interesting. So I'm curious to ask you again, how has the market changed over a period of time? Is it history repeating itself, or does history repeat itself, or does it just rhyme? I'm curious to understand, is it cycles upon cycles, or do you see the patterns? What happens?
History definitely repeats itself, because in the end, the market's made up of human beings. Mm. Humans just don't change. Mm. Fear and greed always drives the markets, and that is what the markets is. It's just a bunch of human beings buying and selling and basing their decision-making on whatever that's happening in the markets of what their opinion is. Mm. So from that point of view, it probably will never change. Despite the technology we have, the high-speed trading, the artificial intelligence, things like that, it's still going to be the same, driven by humans. On the other hand, though, I always also said says that it rhymes, because it's definitely not the exact thing. So in other words, whatever created the GFC, which was a subprime crisis of the residential sector of the United States, it is not going to happen again. So what's going to create the next GFC is going to be totally different. And what that may be, it'll be totally different to what it was in the past.
Mm.
So we will definitely have another recession, but it won't be the same cause as the past one.
And do you have any view as to when that recession might be coming?
There's this view which I was trying to debunk basically over the last couple of months, and it was actually really good because a month ago, all this talk of recession, and we went shopping. So we took advantage of that. And again, it was very extremely profitable for us and 600 others. So I talked a month ago, I talked about a recession, what creates recessions. And we are definitely not in one, and we're not going to have one for at least the next maybe 1 or 2 years.
Mm.
That may change. It might speed up depending on what happens with the trade war. However, at this point in time, no data suggests that there's a recession. Because what you typically see in a recession, for example, right? The one thing that one of the causes of recessions is high interest rates. But at the moment, we definitely have very low interest rates across the globe. And in extreme cases like Europe, they're going negative interest rates, which is quite extraordinary. On the other hand, in terms of another recessionary factor that can create it is a high unemployment rate. At the moment, in actual fact, we have almost full employment rate, extremely low in unemployment rate. So therefore, what that means is everybody has a job. And when they have a job, what happens? They've got money.
Mm.
People go out there and spend. When I'm out there now these days in restaurants, you see it's full. As long as the restaurant's good, it's full.
Hmm.
People are spending, they're spending very freely. There's nobody technically tightening up their belts. And if there's plenty of spending, consumer confidence is high, the recession isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So those couple of factors alone allows you to know that for a fact that there's definitely nowhere near the recession that a lot of people are fearing.
Okay, cool. So Terry, you're going to be coming to talk at our Practice Max event in a couple of months, which we're very much looking forward to. Our community is really excited to have you there. What sort of things are you going to be talking about during that conversation? Because I think, again, I just want to paint the picture for what they're up for, because I know that there's a lot of anticipation about your arrival. There's a lot of anticipation about what we're going to be covering. So what sort of things are you going to be speaking about at that event?
I'm actually really excited, Jesse, because one of the things that I want to, basically I'm going to run it almost like a workshop style, because I want your people to understand that one of the most important things about making money in the markets is firstly, not about only choosing the right stock, but how to avoid 99% of the right one of the wrong ones.
Yeah.
So I will be sharing the four criteria that will easily eliminate 99% of all the rubbish stocks that's globally listed, and only focus on the 1%. And if you focus on the 1%, they are the best and cream of the crop. And those four numbers, they're free because they're from annual reports, and you can screen those stocks very, very easily within a couple of minutes.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I know you're excited to be coming. We're very excited to be coming too, mate. It's going to be a cracking event, and we can't wait to have you there at the Gold Coast. It's going to be wonderful. So, Terry, just coming back to creating wealth outside the business, because ultimately that's really what the purpose of this conversation is about, helping dentists understand why it's important to create wealth outside the business as a risk mitigation strategy, giving them peace of mind at night, allowing them to potentially reinvest further into their business should they choose to later. So as we go back to that conversation, if there's anything you wanted to leave the audience with, just as thought starters or, dare I say, the gospel according to Terry, what sort of things would you like to leave the audience with as they think about creating an income stream outside of their practice?
I would say that actually one word or one sentence easily sums it up. I'll probably say that compounding waits for nobody.
Yeah.
So start. No matter how small the cash or the surplus cash flow it is, it does not matter. The main thing is start, because for a fact, you're on board. So you're going to be helping them increase that cash flow. And I know that for a fact. So while you're, no matter how small, you can start small, get used to it, get used to the whole process on a small scale. And then by the time the flood of surplus cash flow comes from the business, you know exactly what to do with it.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that. Compounding. Didn't Albert Einstein call it the eighth wonder of the world?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
He did.
So, ladies and gents, time is your friend when it comes to compounding.
Definitely.
And so for those people, just actually on that, Terry, for someone who might be in their 50s and going, oh my goodness, I don't have that amount of time, is it a case of throwing the arms up in the air and going, too late, I'm just going to go and have another party? Or probably not. But what would you say to someone listening who's a little bit older as well, just when they're thinking, oh my God, I don't have 30, 40 years to compound?
You don't need that. Provided you're not sitting on top of, but going basically relying on and happy with a 2% interest rate bearing account, then yes, you'll have a problem. But the rule of 72 is that the higher rate of return that you can generate on an annual basis, it really speeds up the process.
Yep.
For example, I'll give you an example. Say a 7% account, you're very able to achieve a decent 7% return. Pretty good. That's an average return. And a lot of people are probably happy with that, with the way things are going. But if you're able to take that to 15 and 20%, just by tripling that yearly annual return basis, some years you'll get it, some years you won't, some years you exceed that by a mile. But just say on average, you'd be able to get that 15 to 20% return. Although it's only the tripling of a percentage-wise, compounding over a 10, 15-year period, it can mean the difference between 10 to almost 20 times the actual dollar outcome at the end.
Wow.
So that's the difference. And that's why compounding is so powerful and why we chase every percentage point. Because that every percentage point actually does matter.
Yeah, and because every percentage point compounds over time.
Correct.
Yeah, love it. Mate, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. I'm so excited that you're coming to the Gold Coast to come and talk to our tribe, our community. Thank you for agreeing to do that. It's going to be epic. We can't wait to have you there. And we're hoping for good weather, of course, so that we can get out and enjoy the sun, which today in Canberra is a little bit absent. But anyway, that's all right. So, mate, from all of us here at Savvy Dentist, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time today. Really generous, really wonderful. And just to wrap up, mate, I reckon your mum must be super proud of all you've achieved, mate, because what a beginning. And look what you've gone on to achieve. She must be super proud. So well done to you, my friend.
Thank you, Jesse. And happy that I'm here as well. Awesome.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.